Thank you very much, Harvey. I was over to visit at one of the tables. Dave Rowe said to me, "Has he given you your present yet?" And I didn't know what he meant. But David Rowe, who is the president of the AFL-CIO, always makes sure that I'm reminded of my duties. I want to tell you, in light of some of the things I've been through in politics, I should have been wearing a hard hat years before. It's a little late, but I'm very grateful to you. Let me very quickly just pay our respects on behalf of Muriel and myself to each and every one of you here tonight that have made this wonderful evening possible. I've been involved in enough occasions similar to this to know that a tremendous amount of work goes into it. And I also know, gentlemen, that when you want something done and done well, you get out of the way and let the women handle it. And that is true. And I want to thank all of the ladies, the women that have made this event such a spectacular affair. The floral display was simply beautiful. The fashion show was a little more than I was able myself to fully understand. I asked somebody about it. They said, "Well, it's the peasant motif." And then I asked Harvey, as they were going by, these very lovely models, and they were so very attractive and all, and I said, "Harvey, what do you think one of those dresses costs?" And he told me, I said, "No wonder they call it peasants. By the time you buy one, you'll be a peasant." But now, I don't want Carl Erickson to take this as any personal comment at all. But you can see that Carl is prosperous. Look at that fine tan that he has there. And we're very singularly, let me say, grateful to you and to Dayton's for making these facilities available for this beautiful occasion. So to both Mr. and Mrs. Carl Erickson, our very sincere thanks to you, Carl. And to the doctors that are here and their ladies, Dr. Joseph Sella, and to Dr. Everett Smith and Mrs. Smith, we thank you, and others that are here. And Fred Dresser, well, Fred has been writing to me, and last year you were the head man too, Fred. Yes. And when you get a good man, you never let him go. And when he asked me if I would participate and whether Muriel and I would share this evening, we were very pleased to do so. And to Harvey and Mrs. McKay, very special thanks. Harvey, I knew you'd get in a plug for the stadium. He isn't a one-track mind fellow, but he does spend a lot of time on that stadium. Lest anybody have any doubts. By the way, I didn't know about this naming. I liked it. Somebody mentioned that to me, but I didn't believe it. There is a very good reason to build that stadium. I think it should be done. We're out to the International Airport Charter Service this afternoon, and they sort of, Muriel, they dedicated that because they knew I've been flying around a great deal. And I told them that we'd had several things now named after me. First of all, we have some children. That helps. And then they named an old folks home, a senior citizens home up in Wadena after me. They named a mile and a half of road out in Colorado after me. I don't know why, but they sent us a sign and we have it posted up out at Waverly. And when I was vice president and chairman of the Space Council, I went down to Cape Kennedy or Cape Canaveral and found out that while we were able to put a man on the moon, we were able to circumnavigate the surface of the globe, we weren't able to get people across from the mainland to the Cape, to the island on which we had the launching for our space satellites. They had one two-lane bridge to take 20,000 people back and forth per day. And I put my brilliance to and on my brilliant mind on it, and I figured out if they had two bridges that it would help. And spent a lot of time getting that done, and so they call them the Hubert Humphrey Bridges. So you see, I have made great progress in my public life, but the climax of it all would be, and I hope that it will really come about, is to have that stadium out there, because I'm a great Vikings fan. And I wouldn't want them to go to any place where it's warmer than Minnesota. We just got to have them. Well, it is a special privilege to share in this evening. And I know you're going to have a good time, and I'm not going to keep you too long because I know you like to dance. You've had a great and delicious dinner. There's good sociability here. You're seeing some old friends, as I am. It's been a wonderful evening for me. And I like to dance, and I want you to get at it. But I want to talk to you about a little serious business for a moment, because what we're here for is a very important cause, the work of the American Cancer Society and the efforts of the Minnesota chapter, the work of some, 65,000 or more volunteers in this state. And I believe it's worthy of us to take just a little time to think about what it's all about. The real truth is that no family in this nation is immune to this disease. It is the terrible disease. It is the killer disease. It strikes 1 in 4 Americans and kills 2 out of every 3 of those that it strikes. And I think we have good reason, therefore, to want to be involved. Even if your own family is spared, and pray God it may be, you probably will have a number of your friends who are among cancer's victims, or the families of your friends. All of us have some direct or indirect experience with the physical and the emotional ravages of this illness, and one is almost as bad as the other. The economic costs are incalculable. Productive lives are cut short. And then there's that high cost of prolonged care that can be a personal or a family catastrophe. As most of you know here, we've had our difficulties, our troubles in our own family, and therefore have a special interest. I find that most of the things in which you have a deep interest come as a result of some personal experience. And most of you, I think, if you'll think back over the things in which you're really interested, in which you give so much of yourself, it's because something happened to you, or your family, or one of your friends, or somebody that's close to you. And then all at once, what seemed to be just a topic becomes something of the heart and of the mind. We've had our problems in the family. Our son, one son, thank God, has not had a recurrence of it some 13 years ago. I've written about that when our son Robert was taken down with it. Dr. Kennedy's here tonight, and he was so helpful to us. I want him to know how much we appreciate it. My brother Ralph, I was stricken with cancer. In the instance of our son, I think he survived it because of early detection. In the instance of my brother, I think we lost him because there wasn't early detection. In my own case, I've had the best of medical care. And for several years, when there was some concern about the possibility, I had regular physical checkups. But even that was not enough. So we've had some personal experience with it. And I can tell you that I know what it means to get in the ring and fight the battle, what it means physically, what it means emotionally. And I can also tell you that you really get a new look on life. You get a different perspective. You begin to understand the genuine meaning of life. You have a deep appreciation of your spiritual faith. It becomes new. It becomes something that is very precious to you. You have a great and deep appreciation of the doctors and the scientists, the technicians that make it possible for you to live, or to at least have a fighting chance to live. And you have a very deep appreciation of your friends. We're talking up here this evening. We were literally inundated with letters the time that I was in the hospital, and flowers which we were able to share with others. But I have to be frank with you. I found my experience in the hospital, while it was, you know, I didn't like it, obviously, but quite frankly, I didn't suffer any real pain, suffered some emotional concern. But once I got up and moved around, I started visiting with everybody in the hospital. You would imagine I would do that. I decided to pay house calls on practically everybody that I could find. And I found people who had it worse than I did. I went down to the 5th floor of Memorial Hospital in New York, saw the children's ward, which is something that could break your heart. But you know those children, it was on Halloween, they sent me up a big pumpkin. I got the most beautiful letters from them, the loveliest little cards, and even to this day, I hear from many of them. A little girl that was in the next room, the room next to me, Debbie. I don't remember her last name. Pardon me if I get a tear in my eye when I think about that. But Debbie hadn't walked. She'd had cancer of the spine. She'd never been able for a year and a half to walk, but she was hoping and praying that she would, and her mother and father would come every day. And while I was there, I kept talking to Debbie. I was there a little over, what was it, Mary, about 3 weeks? Yeah, about 3 weeks. And I could have gone home a little earlier, but I liked the nurses and I liked the care. I really did. And the Muriel would say, well, now we can go home. I said, no, I want to be sure when I get out of here that I feel good, you know. But I remember little Debbie. She was about 16 years old. And I used to say to her every day, I said, hey, when, you know, we got a date. But it wouldn't look right for me just to be hanging around your bedroom here. I said, you know, we got to get up and walk up and down the hall. And I kept at it day after day. And, you know, before I left, not because of me, but because of the care she was getting, and maybe because of a little encouragement, she started to walk. And she did walk. And I heard from her, and she's out now. She's really getting along beautifully. She's back in school. A year and a half that she'd been there, unable to walk. It can happen. I remember one old gentleman that was in the bedroom, and his wife came to me and said, you've got to talk to him. He will not be operated upon. And I said, well, you know, I didn't even know that family. I said, really, your sons are here and your daughter is here? And he said, no, he likes you and he knows about you. If you would talk to him, I think he'd let the doctors operate. And I said, well, why don't you just let it take its time? So every day I take my walks around that corridor. It was on the 8th floor, wasn't it, Muriel? I'd walk around the corridor there, and nurse alongside of me there, we're chatting and stopping with people and talking to them. And one day I stopped by and saw this old gentleman, and I said to him, say, I said, I hear that you're going to have surgery. No. And I said, well, listen, I tell you, you ought to do it. You know, when I came in here, I felt just about like you did. And I talked to him. I said, why don't you get out of bed and you and I take a walk? I said, I'm getting tired of walking with these nurses all the time. Why don't you and I just walk? And we started a walking pattern for the next 3 days. And then his wife came to call on me and said, you know, Daddy is going to let the doctor operate on him. And by the way, I've heard from him. He's come along great. He's fine. As a matter of fact, he's a whole lot better off than I am. He should have been getting me out of bed and walking me around. Well, I can tell you a whole lot of those kind of yarns. I get letters every day from people who are suffering from this disease. I put in anywhere from 5 to 6 telephone calls a day, calling people all around the country. Mothers will call me and tell me that their son is sick with it, or their daughter. Or I had a son call me, I was telling here at the table, told me that his father was a terminal case, that he couldn't get out of bed, he couldn't walk, and he was just literally wasting away. Would I write him a letter? I wrote him a good one, a real whippersnapper. And Rudy, one that you know that that you'd like to get one of those political kind of letters. And I wrote him an upbeat letter, and then I wrote him a second one. And I got a letter just about 10 days ago from the son that said Dad had that letter by his bedside every day and read it every day. And he called me last week and said, come see me, we're going to start to walk. And he has been walking and walking and getting some strength back. And by whatever the miracle is, he's beginning to feel good. There is hope. It's not only a matter of your mind and of your spirit, which by the way is important, which you can convey to people, and you must convey that. You must never ever see anybody and tell them that it's hopeless. But there is hope, and the hope is in medical care, early detection. The hope is in health care, basic health care. And the hope sometimes is in surgery and chemotherapy and radiation. We've got lots of things. There are people here that are experts in this audience that have made fantastic advances in this treatment of this dread disease. And those of you that have been out there on the hustings, so to speak, making these house calls, asking for help, you didn't only ask for a donation. You actually served as an educational force by alerting many, many people to the danger signals of cancer and to the need, as I've said, for early detection and treatment. Now, you volunteers have had really a tremendous success. Every year, you have repeated this exercise, and besides that, you've topped what you did the year before. And the money that the volunteers raise goes, of course, for the American Cancer Society's research programs and treatment programs. This money supports research, it supports education, it supports services. And of course, the biggest share of the funds goes to advanced research, and we're doing great things. But you do more than money, you do more than raise money, you actually save lives. Tonight I spoke to a few people in the media, and I said to them, you know, what we're doing is this, that the life that you seek to save may very well be your own. The life that you seek to save may very well be your own. In 1970, I spoke to this to the American Cancer Society meeting here in Minneapolis. And I tried to give a little upbeat message. I didn't have the slightest idea that I might very well at that time be talking about my own life. I thought I was talking about somebody else's. And in this room tonight amongst the volunteers, the life that you seek to save most likely will be your own. So work hard. Even from the point of helping others, you also help yourself. Well, let me just tell you about some of the developments. I won't keep you too long. In 1971, I remember when I returned to the Senate, that we passed the National Cancer Act. I was a co-sponsor of that act. And it is a basic commitment by the government of the United States to create or to launch a deliberate blueprint, the National Cancer Program, to guide a forward-looking, aggressive, high-priority research and treatment campaign against cancer. This was literally a legislative milestone. We have the National Cancer Institute. It's a tremendous endeavor, really a great facility. The funds which have been made available to this institute spearhead this great research program, and those funds are spread all through America, through our colleges and our universities and our medical schools and our laboratories. We started out in 1971 with appropriations of $180 million. This last year, we had them up to $816 million. This is a costly battle. But $816 million a year and a war to save people's lives? Very, very little. We're going to spend $120 billion this year on our defense program alone. $816 million is two-thirds of a Trident submarine. $816 million is equivalent to about 14 B-1s. It's not that much money out of a $1.5 trillion economy. And when you think of the fact that out of that money will come lives that are prolonged, lives that are saved, cures that are made, pain that's relieved, massive medical breakthroughs, not only in the treatment of cancer, but as the scientists and the doctors work to find the cause and the cure of cancer, they come across so many other developments. Biomedical research has made almost gigantic steps forwards in the last few years because of this sustained effort on our part. And the American Cancer Society has been pouring in its money, raising funds all over this land, and we don't want all the money just from the government. The unique thing about this America of ours is that it is a partnership when it's at its best between its government and its people. Even if we could get all the money out of what we call federal or state revenues, it wouldn't be what it should be. We need to do what we're doing with people involved, because you're the outreach. The funds that the federal government could give would not be able to get out and warn people about the need of early detection. Nor would it permit somebody to come out and just shake hands and say, look, you know, you're going to have people say to you as you go to the door, my wife has cancer, or I have it, or my son or daughter has it, or my uncle has it, or my grandfather. And that gives you one chance that you can ought to hold as a very precious opportunity, a chance to say, we're going to try to help your mother, your father, your son, your grandfather. That's what this program is all about. We're going to help. That gives that person encouragement from that moment on. And encouragement is part of the battle. It's part of the therapy, part of the medicine that's needed. And there are some real wonderful success stories. Look at the breakthroughs that have been made in breast cancer treatment in the past year or two. Really fantastic. The breakthroughs that have been made in the treatment of leukemia and many other parts of it. I'm no expert in this, but I'll tell you, you sure learn a lot in a hurry when You need to, you know. Minnesota's great centers of research are involved in this. We have a special involvement, the Mayo Clinic, the University of Minnesota Medical School. No finer medical research establishments in the world. And the American Cancer Society is deeply involved with these two great institutions. And as I told you, we are saving lives. And upon basic research depend all of our technologies for prevention, for diagnosis and treatment, such as the combined therapy that have lowered the recurrence rate of major forms of cancer. Now, there's no question that the cancer patient has a better chance today than he had last year. There's no doubt that the cancer patient today has a better chance for survival than they had 5 years ago. And we may very well be right on the threshold of tremendous breakthroughs in this disease, because there are so many other things that are happening that we seldom hear about. In his annual report, Benno Smith, who's an old friend of mine, chairman of the President's Cancer Panel, said that we know with absolute certainty that cancer is a soluble problem. And because there are so many different types, my goodness, it's varieties beyond almost comprehension. Many solutions are required. Progress, the time seems painfully slow, and no earlier universal breakthrough can be anticipated next week or tomorrow. But like most things in life, you have to have a lot of hope and a lot of faith. It is now recognized that as much as 80% of all cancer, according to one report, and these figures are sometimes not too accurate, but a very substantial percent of all cancer is environmental in origin. Therefore, we're going to have to increase our research into the environmental factors, as well as to explore the links between nutrition, the food that we consume, and our health and our illness. Let me get in my little plug, not only for the stadium, but for something that I believe very strongly. We have got to rethink the whole subject of health care. We have been spending most of our money on curative medicine. We've been spending most of our money on hospitals to take care of people when they're sick. Our doctors spend most of their time with patients who are already in trouble. We have got to start to think about how to keep ourselves well. And that means to think through nutrition, physical fitness, the environmental factors. This society of ours is the victim of chemicals, no doubt about it, in everything we touch and eat and do. And I hope and pray that the younger group that's represented here tonight will keep in mind that we've made tremendous progress in curative medicine, but in preventive medicine, we're a long ways yet to go. And I believe that that's part of the answer, not only from the relief of pain and suffering and disease, but the relief from incredible costs. Now, knowing that this war can be fought and won, and we do know that, it would be nothing short of immorality and a major crime if we lack the tenacity, the patience, and the commitment to make the necessary effort. Anybody whose family has suffered from this disease, or who personally has felt its scourge, will ever consider the goal of victory ever worth any effort. So we've got to provide the resources through government and through private organizations such as the American Cancer Society. Success will depend upon our will. I want to say something to you. The American people can do anything they want to do if they make up their mind to do it. We have the categorical evidence. We learned how to split the atom out of a theory from a man by the name of Einstein, and we did it when people said it was impossible. You lived at a time when things that were called impossible have become literally commonplace. We have pierced outer space. We put a man on the moon. We have learned how to live in space stations. We penetrate the depths of the sea. We drill in the sea for oil and now for minerals. Things that only a half a century ago were utterly impossible, at best were only a nebulous theory, are a reality today. And therefore, I'm a perpetual optimist. When people say to me, you know, Humphrey, the trouble with you, and I have a lot of them tell me what my troubles are. They'll say to me, you know, you're kind of childlike in your optimism. And I say, I should say I am. First of all, this is a young country. We're not old. We are a spirited people. And we need leadership that is spirited, zealous, adventurous, courageous. We don't need tired people. But more importantly, the history of this century and of this nation tells us that whatever we seek to do, if we put the resources to it and have the will to do it, we can do it. That's how we're going to overcome the energy crisis when we just find out that we're going to do it. But you know how we are. We really don't do much until we're in real trouble. I have a little axiom about politics. I said, empty stomach, full head, full stomach, empty head. As long as everything's going on good, why worry, even though they tell you that you ought to look down the road? We generally don't take care of our health until we're sick. We generally don't take care of our resources until we think they're running out. Most people don't really reorganize and revise their business until they begin to find out they're going broke. But then all at once the day of truth hits you, the hour of truth. And the hour of truth has come in the cancer fight. Because if we should let up for 1 year, we would lose momentum that would take from us more lives than any war that we've ever fought in. I hear people wring their hands, and rightly so, of the tragedy of our war in Southeast Asia. Have you ever stopped to think how little money we spend on the war on cancer as compared to that war? More lives are taken, more suffering, more agony, more incredible pain each year from cancer than from any year of that war. And it hits more families. So I want you to redouble your efforts. I want you to go away from here knowing that you're really doing something. You may not know it. You may not feel that you're that important, but you are. You may make the difference. You may raise the money that will give some money to that doctor, that scientist that makes the breakthrough. We don't know where those people are. And that's one of the reasons I believe we need to bring more and more people into our great universities. That we need to tap this great source of brain power that's out here without regard to race, color, or creed. Because somewhere out there, some laboratory, at some university, at some hospital, in the mind of some young man or some woman, there is the answer. Because I happen to believe that the good Lord intends for us to find this answer. The day of miracles is not over. The day of miracles has just started. And you have a chance to be a part of it. Thank you very much.